everybody. This is Joe Vecchio, Cuppa Joe Radio Show, cupjoe.blogspot.com, voice of the working man. And as some of you know, my wife passed away recently. That's why we're not doing the full intro. This is a show that's dedicated to her, and I just didn't feel it was right to have the regular full intro for something like this. This is kind of a catharsis. Is that the right word for it? I'm going to talk about Kathy, and I'm going to talk about her from my point of view, but also from the point of view of, you know, what's wrong with America, why someone like that was always in poverty and always in money trouble, and all that stuff. I'm here with my friend Phyllis Euster of CountPaperBallots.com. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, Joe.
Phyllis knew both of us, and she helped us out a lot when we were in trouble, when we were getting evicted from our apartment. In fact, you didn't even know us, did you?
I met you through an email from the Howard Dean folks.
Yeah, but we had never met in person.
Not at all.
And you helped put us up in your place for, about 2 or 3 weeks. You helped me find a job, helped me get an apartment.
You did all that.
Well, I wouldn't have been able to get the job if it hadn't been for you driving me to
the
services.
Oh, we just drove around. It was no big deal.
But yeah, it's one of the examples of what Democrats really need to do, help each other more.
Yeah, why aren't Democrats helping each other anymore? None of my Democrat friends do any of that kind of stuff.
A lot of them are just broke, and it goes back to the high horse Democrats that I talk about, people who talk big about ideals, but in practice, don't follow it.
I think most Democrats have morphed into either moderates or Republicans because a lot of my Democrat friends, they laugh at me when I say that I would help the homeless people. And, you know, for me, it was just giving a floor in my house. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't cost me anything to help people.
Well,
it made me feel good.
I appreciate it, and Kathy certainly appreciated it. She really loved you like a sister, you know.
Yeah, but you guys turned around and became real friends to me when I had some trouble.
Sure, you know, it's just always reciprocal.
And I'm gonna miss Kathy. And Joe, you're doing amazing. I'm really proud of you. I know it's been hard on you, but I just think you're a very strong character.
Well, I handle the bigger stuff better than I handle the smaller stuff. You know, you've seen me get mad when I'm driving.
You love to bitch.
I bitch all the time when I'm driving. It's get in this lane. Get in this lane. Don't watch this guy.
You turn into a real New Yorker.
I'm a real backseat driver, and I know I can't help it because when I'm used to driving a certain way. And you, what's the biggest thing I bitch about you about that you always get too close behind
right.
somebody? And that drives me crazy because I'm always worried that the guy's going to pull up short and then we're going to wind up ramming. And no matter what happens, you're always considered to be at fault. But, you know, I always follow – you talk about car lengths. I do the 3-second rule. When you see when somebody's past something, you count 3 seconds. And if your car hasn't reached that point in 3 seconds, you're okay. Because that works regardless of what speed you're working at.
Yeah.
Because with the higher speed, it means in a longer distance you got to go. But Kathy was horrible with cars. Kathy, in fact, wrecked my Hyundai, which was a 2000 Hyundai, and I wouldn't have been able to keep it anyway because I was unemployed and there was no way I was going to be able to keep up the payments. But Kathy had an accident, and Kathy actually had wrecked every single car she had ever driven. So after that, it was kind of like,
what was that about?
Well, she had a problem with paying attention, and she also had a problem with dyslexia,
okay.
Where she goes. She had sometimes trouble telling. For those of you who aren't aware of how things happen, my wife came here about 5 years ago. She was here May 25th, 2000, I think, or 1999, something like that. And she had been living out in California. I first met her. Let me go back a little further. Let me be anal retentive here. I first met Kathy when I was in high school. We had known each other back then, back at Lake Howell High School in Maitland, Florida, a real piece of shit high school. I spent my final year there, my final year in high school, because we had just moved from New York. And Kathy was going with Glenn, who would eventually become her first husband and the father of her 3 children. And I was so immature at the time. And I was 16 years old. Yes, I graduated very young. I graduated when I was 16. I was 16 years old, and I had all the raging hormones. And I had the hots for Kathy. And it was really nothing more than that at that time. But just having the hots for her wasn't really quite enough because I knew there was something special about Kathy right away, as everybody did when they first met her. And the big thing about Kathy is that there was nothing that was phony about her. The one thing I hate most in people, and one of the reasons why I can't stand a lot of Republicans, is that they're phony. And a lot of what I call the high horse Democrats is that they're just phony. They'll say one thing and they'll pretend they're one way, but when it comes to actual actions, they simply won't do it. There was nothing phony about Kathy. But she was strongly in love with Glenn at the time, and I knew that there was no way I was mature enough to be able to deal with a relationship. And as she told me later on, she was scared of me. She was scared of me. We did have some things in common, though. She did want to be friends, and we had a television show called Star Blazers, which was an animated show that we both liked. And she used to come over very early in the morning, like 6:30, because she had to get up early anyway, and she worked kind of near where I used to live. And she would come over there, and we'd watch Star Blazers before she went in to work. And she was living with her sister Helen at the time. And we were all one big group. It was her and Helen and Chris Calhoun and Glenn Foldy. We were like the group. We all hung out together and all that stuff. And I had the hots for Kathy, and here she was coming to my room all the time. But I couldn't get that close to her, you know, as much as I wanted to. But then she got married, I joined the service, and I went away. And she wound up eventually moving to California. Get that little thing hanging down off the bed. I hate that. And she wound up moving out to California, and I went into service. And in about maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and I know I'm dragging on, Phyllis. You want to say stuff, but I'm dragging on. I called her up. What some people don't know is that Kathy and I had the same birthday. We were both born on November 15th. She was born 2 years before me. And we, I called her up on our birthday just to see how she was doing. And after talking to her for a while, I realized that I still had feelings for her. And I thought to myself, if the feelings are still there after all this time, and this, we're talking about almost over 20 years had passed since we had known each other. If the feelings were still that strong, well, almost 20, close to that. If they were still that strong after all this time, then there must be something real. And we started talking. At that time, she was married to her second husband, Lee. And at the time, she was very happy, and I was happy for her, even though I was lonely and I hadn't really had much in the way of dating. And I think part of that was because I was still holding a torch for Kathy. I still kind of wanted her, and not just in a cheap sex way. I just wanted to be with her because she was always great to talk to, and we could talk about different things. And then things started getting worse with her husband, and then she got cancer, and things went really bad because when they first got married, she was married to Glenn for 10 years, and then she was married to Lee for 10 years, which is remarkable. She was only married to me for half of that time before she passed on, but she was not very happy with the way things were turning out. It started off well with Lee and with Glenn, and then it kind of went sour. And I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to get into too much personal details, but let's just say, you know, it was just a point in time where, you know, they were falling out in love, so to speak. But Kathy had 3 kids. It wasn't just like I can say, well, come out here. It was very difficult. Now, her oldest son, James, came out here. God, I don't forget what year, but he came out here, and I had an extra room at where I was living. It was in a house, and he stayed with us for a while. And then, much later on, she finally came out. And this was after she had already gone through the cancer and all that stuff, and through the chemo. And the chemo, I think, is what eventually wound up killing her, not by itself, but because it weakened her body. And her body was already fairly weak to begin with. But part of it was also because Kathy had basically worked herself to death. She had been working almost nonstop since she was in high school. In fact, only the short time she had over here was when she really didn't have to work to be the sole supporter of the family. She did that for a little while here, and she was extremely dedicated to her job. She worked in a little veterinarian's clinic, and she helped clean the dogs and do all something. She loved animals. God, she loved animals. She loved all kinds of animals. And it was real hard for her because we really aren't allowed to have pets where we're at. And I'm allergic if we have too many animals. I couldn't go in the back where she used to work because I would start coughing and wheezing. Not because of one single dog, but there were so many of them. And there was just hair all over the place. And I just couldn't handle that. And cats didn't bother me so much, but I can't stand when people have too many cats. I can't stand that cat smell, you know. But at any rate, she loved animals, and when she wrecked the car, she would walk back and forth. This was up in Alpharetta where there are no sidewalks, and it was a really long, it was about an hour and a half to walk down there every single day. But she did it. And this is with a problem with her hernia and with she had cystic fibrosis tumors. And God, well, you know, when you first saw her, you saw even then even though she was healthier then than she wound up being later, she was still in pretty good health.
I knew the day I met Kathy that she had major health issues.
Yeah. And she had went in about 2 years ago. She went in the hospital with very high cholesterol and an enlarged liver. And they did a biopsy on her, which was very painful. She was in the hospital for about 2 weeks. And this was at DeKalb Medical Center, which is a good hospital. DeKalb Medical is a good hospital. And then she came home, and then she was doing a little better for a while. And she had the tumors inside her, which made her look like she was like 3 months pregnant. And she finally had that operated on. That was in May of this year. In fact, it was just like a week before my sister's wedding. We were supposed to go up there up in New York, but she couldn't go because she was still recovering. I was going to stay home, but she's like, Joe, you're driving me crazy. Get out of here. You know, go up there and be with your sister and you know, be at the wedding and all that. But anyway, we went out. Well, she stayed healthy, and then about early July, she started having problems with her stomach again. And then she got really, really bad one night. She was just nothing but crying and wheezing. And you saw her. Phyllis came.
Well, she couldn't keep anything down.
Yeah, she couldn't keep anything down, but she was always in pain.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
She was bent over, and she couldn't sleep, and she was always crying, and always just what's the word? Bent over. And, you know, so we took her to the hospital, and this was on July 10th, and that's when she was diagnosed with pancreatitis, which is something I didn't know too much about before. I didn't know anything about. Pancreatitis is an inflammation of the pancreas. And the pancreas is important because it excretes enzymes for digestion. And it also creates insulin. And she was diabetic. On top of everything else, she was diabetic. So that's, you know, part of also what brought on the problem. But I'm wondering if there was all interrelated and all that. High cholesterol, diabetes, and stuff like that. And she was in the hospital for until September 26th when she passed away. And about 3 months before, 3 weeks before she passed away. About over 3 months. And about 3 weeks before she passed away, she had some serious respiratory problems and basically had to be put on a respirator and started to be coma-like. Not totally in a coma, but very much like that. And they moved her from minor intensive care up to serious intensive care. And they did the surgery on her. And they cleaned it. You know, they went in there. And this is what kind of freaked me out when I heard it. They went in there ostensibly to try to remove some fluid from around her pancreas, only to discover she no longer had a pancreas. It had been eaten away completely. And she remained in a comatose condition for 3 weeks with what they call sepsis, which is basically enzymes, digestive enzymes, which got into the bloodstream. And that's basically poison because digestive enzymes break things down. That's what they do. And she became extremely bloated because they had to keep putting fluids in her to keep her hydrated. But the fluids were seeping out into her muscles and stuff and not going out into her veins. And the hope was, and in retrospect, it probably wasn't very much of a hope, but, you know, the doctors were, I guess, trying to be polite, as polite as they possibly could. But in retrospect, you look at it and you think there wasn't really much of a chance. You can live without a pancreas, but the sepsis was slowly killing her. And finally, on September 26th, at 9:10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, she passed away. The weekend before that was Anime Week in Atlanta, and I went up there. And I wasn't visiting the hospital every day like I had been because she was unconscious. And quite frankly, I'll be brutally honest, I could not bear to see her like that. You saw her once, Phyllis.
Oh, and it just wrecked me. It wrecked me to see her all bloated. When the last time I had seen her, she was sitting up in her bed, mm-hmm. laughing, talking about Jonathan and James, and just laughing and telling stories about cats and dogs. Unbelievable.
And she was
so strong. How much she fought till the end.
She really, really fought. She wanted to stay on because she wanted to have more time, and I wanted to have more time with her. And but you know what? We had 5 good years together. It was really not quite 5. It would have been 5 years on this coming May, about 4.5 years. But we had a good time while we were here. And I don't have any sense of regret in terms of, oh, if only I had done this, she would have lived. Because there really was nothing anybody could have done with pancreatitis.
And Grady doing the great job that they did.
Yeah, she went to Grady Memorial Hospital. And if you want to donate money to Grady, please do. Because, you know, they do a wonderful job there. And they really kept her alive a lot longer than she would have been.
Well, those few times that we went, Joe, she had 4 or 5 doctors on her at all times.
Always, always. Well, she was in the heavy intensive care area. Yeah. So, you know, they really kept an eye on her. And Dr. Stevens did a wonderful, wonderful job keeping an eye on her and just watching her. And they were constantly surveying her, and I would go in there maybe once a week just to make sure everything was okay, and, you know, and... But finally, I got the call, and it was the Monday after Anime Week in Atlanta, and I called at around 11 o'clock in the morning, and they seemed to think that she was doing okay. And then I got a call around 5:30 or so saying she had had a heart failure. And, you know, and actually, the impression that I got from the doctor was really like, we really don't think she's going to survive this. Do you want us to keep working on her? And I'm like, well, you know, as long as she's willing to fight. You know, just keep fighting for her. And finally, at around 10 after 9 is when she passed away. And Kathy was cremated, and her ashes were placed with her mother in Orlando, Florida. So they didn't do an autopsy on her because they knew what killed her. So they only do autopsies when they die suddenly and no one's really sure what caused it. In this case, they were absolutely certain. I mean, it was pretty obvious. She had been in the hospital with pancreatitis. There's always going to be a sense of sadness for me for times that we've missed, times that, you know, we hadn't had a chance to do a lot of different things, partly because of her health, partly because of our poverty. But I knew at least that she was happy in her last years. We really, really, I don't know if I can quite explain this to you, because a lot of people who get into a relationship and get married think they're in love, but they're really not in love. There are things that they can't. There are secrets that they don't tell each other. There are things that they don't do together.
Well, and also, you guys were like best friends.
Yeah.
On top of being married and lovers.
Right.
You guys really had a lot in common. You enjoyed time together. I never came over here where you two weren't being loving to each other.
And it was
amazing.
And that was really the key. You
5 years
I mean?
Later, geez, people would kill for that, Joe.
Yeah, I know. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and something that I'll never happen and I'll never have again with anybody else. I'll never have the same
That'll
kind of
different.
Relationship. It'll be different. It will never be as strong because, like you said, we just got along so well. And with somebody else, if I were to do the things that I did around Kathy, there would be a lot of talk and a lot of why are you doing this and why are you doing that. And there's a lot of manipulation that goes involved with being in a relationship. And there was absolutely none of that with Kathy and I. We were absolutely perfect with each other. It's not that we didn't have differences. She had been on the show a few times. If you go back into the archives on the White Rose Society, then you'll know that. She's been on for a few times, and you'll get to listen to her talk, and we talked about religious things. And those were the scene of our biggest arguments, because she was really, really anti-abortion, and she really hated the fact that I took a logical, rational point of view when it came to it, because it was a very emotional issue for her, because she was almost aborted. So, you know, and in that sense, it was very difficult for her to relate to the things that I was talking about. But we had a wonderful time together for the most part, and even our arguments weren't that serious. And it was always, you know, even though I'm mad at you right now, I still love you. You know, and that's a very important thing. And it's something like Phyllis said, it's something that people go through their lives wishing.
I haven't ever had that. I haven't ever had that kind of a communion with someone. Really, mm-hmm. That's the word for it, is communion. And I tell you, what really impressed me around the whole Kathy thing was meeting her kids in a very serious way, because I think I'd only met them that one time in the apartment when you guys were getting evicted, and I see these three teenage kids, and they're just so cute and so sweet. And then I finally got to meet James, and he's this really intelligent, articulate. His dream would be to write a magazine that covers the video game market. He's very passionate about his collection of video games and anime, Japanese anime. And then Christopher, who is just a very sentient being, is the best way to describe it. He's just very adventurous and very smart. And then Jonathan, who, you know, was at the wake. All three of these kids have handled their mother's death. I mean, they're all, what, from ages what?
23 to 17.
17 to 23. It's kind of a tough time. I lost my dad when I was 24, and I still haven't recovered from losing a dad at that age. So it's kind of a hard age to lose a parent.
And they had her sisters were there at the wake also, two of her three. Helen, who was the only sister I really knew, because she was, like I said, she and Kathy were living together for a while. And Helen really took it very hard, because they were very, very close. Because Kathy was the oldest and Helen was the second. So... They you know, they slept in the same room together.
She was probably like the big sis or the mom
yeah,
to her.
Kathy was always the big sister to all of them.
Yeah.
And then there was Jennifer and Roberta. I don't know who's younger. I think Jennifer's the youngest. Jennifer's the kid. But, of course, they're all grown and married and stuff like that. But here's the thing. And Kathy worked so hard all of her life, and she was the nicest person you ever wanted to
meet.
She
was an angel. She would do anything for anybody.
Right. But she was always poor, no matter how hard she worked. And that's one of the things that's wrong with America. Anybody who works that hard and is that honest does not deserve to live the kind of life, economically speaking, that
so
she did.
Why do you think it happens in our society? Is it just the system is set up to create make people who are giving kind people failures?
I think the system is set up to help people out who
are criminals.
Criminals, but who also are willing to step on people to get a little extra money. I think the system actually helps people like that out. And I think it's a damn shame.
Have there ever been cultures that glorified people who were either artistic or just
kind-hearted? Not that I'm aware of.
Or
all those people,
humanistic.
People like that are always treated with contempt by the powers that be, because they don't understand any motive apart from how can we use this to get money.
And yet, aren't they really the ones that keep the fabric of our society together? Like Kathy raising three kids, being the caretaker, caretaking animals in the vet.
To people like, you know, the Bush family and their friends and stuff like that, that's just kind of like, that keeps them away from, getting involved in power plays and stuff like that. You know, it makes it easier for them to go out and do the things that they do.
But I bet if you scoured a rich person's life, you would find the caretakers that brought the quality and the value to their life, whether it be the maid or the chauffeur or the people that watch their animals.
Yeah, but as you and I have discussed, being that rich, and I'm not just talking about making $50,000 to $100,000 a year. That's really peanuts in this day and age. That's the equivalent of what my father and my mother were earning back then. Even though we were poor, we always had food and we always had, you know, paid rent and we always had enough money for entertainment. And now you really have to earn $50,000 to $100,000 to live.
I mean, when I made $100,000, everybody thought I was rich, and I was just kind of really just getting by, really.
Right? Yeah, but still, you had a lot more. I mean, I never made more than about $25,000 in my life.
I don't know how you do it.
And I've made less the last few years. Hell, I have yet to work this year. Have you realized that? I got laid off in Christmas. I have yet to have a job this year, this whole year. And here we are in
October. Which is a shame, because you're one of the smartest people I've ever met.
Well, part of that was because I was trying to take care of Kathy.
Yeah.
And part of it was just because jobs are hard to find. And there are certain jobs that I simply can't get. But this is not about me. I want to talk about how people like Kathy, people who are so caring and giving, always seem to wind up at the bottom, money-wise. All the people I know, like when I delivered pizzas, all the poor people always tip the best.
I remember that. When I delivered pizzas, it was the African-American neighborhoods, the Mexican neighborhoods, that would give you a $5 tip. And doggone it, if you went into the million-dollar homes neighborhoods,
you'd be lucky to get a quarter.
And the only way you'd get a tip is if the kid answered the door.
Yeah.
I always would get upset when that blonde-haired bimbo Dunwoody housewife would answer the door. I knew I was maybe going to get 50 cents if I was lucky.
Because they don't see it that way. You know, they don't realize that.
But, you know, greed begets greed, and those people are not happy. If you look at them, they have to do Valium
just
to survive.
That's fine. I really don't care about that, you know. But Kathy and I should never have gotten in a situation where we were close to being homeless. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
We should never have had to worry about that. And we still would have been homeless if it hadn't been for our landlord, Mark, here. Because, you know, we've been behind on the rent so much. We're like, God, almost a year behind. And he just like, you know, take care of it when we take care of it, which is weird because Mark is kind of a Republican. He's a Fox watching gay Republican, which is really kind of weird. But I don't want to get into that.
But Joe, your life is going to be mirrored by millions of others now that Katrina's happened. So society has to deal with what to do with these people, and where to create the jobs and the economy when what we have is every penny we are in our economy is being spent on a bomb. When a bomb drops, $1 million evaporates.
Well, that's what Eisenhower said.
It doesn't create any more jobs. It doesn't reflow back into the economy. At least when I spend a dollar at McDonald's, some McDonald's employee is getting a paycheck.
Right.
You know?
Well, isn't that what Eisenhower said? He said every bomb that's made, every landmine, every gun is a dollar that's stolen. There's money that's stolen from poor people, you know, from housing, from things like that. You know, there's still so much wealth in this country, and all of it's just being concentrated into the hands of a very, very few people. We're talking about maybe 10 or 20,000 people.
But we can boycott those people. I mean, in the history of all the robber barons, you know, the steel magnates.
Yeah, but
and
you know what? You know
Vanderbilts.
What? We hurt ourselves. You know, the working people who vote these kind of people in the office and who go out and support. You know, the people who shop at Walmart really piss me off, especially when they know what Walmart does and how they treat their employees.
They probably don't know, Joe, because the press hasn't told
them. But you can get an idea. I mean, if you know somebody who's worked for Walmart or something like that, you can get an idea that something's not right. And they just – not only do they go there, but they sing its praises like crazy without even realizing perhaps the effect that the Walmarts are having and driving down – wages for everybody. And the people who continue to vote Republican. You know, I used to say when Bush got into office in 2000, I said, I want everybody to hang on to their tax returns for this year and see how much you were paying in taxes compared to what your salary was. 4 years from now, take a look at that and compare it to your tax return for that year and see if you're still paying the same amount of taxes than you were before, if your taxes were really getting cut, your federal taxes. And then ask yourself, if you're going to continue to vote Republican based on the premise that they're going to lower your taxes, and you still vote for them even though your taxes haven't changed at all, which they didn't, by the way. In fact, the burden on us has gotten worse, if not just in the federal taxes, but in things like price of gas and stuff like that. And you continue to vote Republican, then there's something mentally wrong with you because you're basically voting to put a rope around your neck. You might as well just shoot yourself. Well, what was it?
It's ignorance.
There was a movie, and I don't remember if I mentioned this in the last show, but if I did, I'm going to say it again. There was a movie called Stand By Me. Did you ever see this movie about Joe Brown, I think his name was? He was a high school principal, or he was actually a middle school principal. Up in New Jersey, and he was very, very strict. He's a black guy. He was very, very strict. And he was right in some of the things he did, but he went overboard. But there was one scene that I thought was really poignant. There was a young boy who had gotten suspended because he was doing drugs. And the boy came back to the principal crying that he wanted to be reinstated. And the principal was having none of it. And he took the kid, and he took him up to the roof of the school. And he took him up to the edge, and he said, jump. Just jump. You know, you're going to keep on taking drugs. You might as well kill yourself now and get it over with rather than die a slow, painful death. Just kill yourself right now. And that's how I feel about people who continue to vote Republicans. Working people who earn a regular paycheck, who are seeing the value of what they earn go less and less every single day. You know, if you're going to continue to vote Republican, take a gun to your head and pull the trigger. Throw yourself in front of a train track. Jump off a high building. Kill yourselves. Do yourselves a favor, because you're killing yourself by voting in for these politicians. And you know what? Let me tell you something. My wife would have died here in the room if it wasn't for Grady Hospital. She would have died a lot quicker, and she would never have even had a fighting chance for life but for Grady Hospital. And the reason why that is because Grady Hospital was built specifically to deal with the poor. If we didn't live in DeKalb County, Georgia, and we had to go to DeKalb Medical Center or some other place, they would not have taken her, perhaps, at least not have kept her in the hospital for a long time. We had no insurance. We had no money. We had nothing. Yet they cared for her like she was a fucking millionaire.
Not only that, but she got better care than if she were at Northside, some of these rich hospitals, because Emory University students who need practice, who need a working live environment, some of the best doctors money can buy are at Grady.
Mm-hmm.
And it's truthful. When they told me, and I believed Dr. April, when she said, a wonderful African-American woman, she looked young, but she was smart as a whip. And young doesn't matter, because these are people who really truly are in it for the medicine, as opposed to the jaded 30-year doctors that just see it like a body shop or a factory. And you can tell when a doctor walks in a room and his eyes are glazed over that he's lost the love of caring for people. But she, you know, Dr. April said Kathy would have died much sooner. Dr. April, what was her last name?
Stevens.
Dr. April Stevens did a really great job. And you're right, Grady. Being a publicly funded, Grady is a socialistic program. There's no other way to look at it. But you know what? Half of Europe has socialized medicine. And it works.
And my only,
there's no other way to say it.
My only complaint about Grady was that they were slow as hell. But you know what? Considering the number of people they do. And you went, the short time you were there. And keep in mind, I was going there pretty much every single day for like three months. And I had been going there on and off to go to the pharmacy to get Kathy's medicines. And she had so many medicines. So many different pills she was taking for so many different things.
Well, we're a toxic society. Yeah. Rather than fix the problem, they'd rather just give you a pill.
Yeah, but you know, some of that stuff, she, you know, the Paxil, trust me, you would she needed the Paxil.
Yeah.
Because when she wasn't on it, you could tell the difference.
But you can't give somebody 13 medicines and not think that they're not all interacting inside her body.
Part of me wonders if it wasn't the confluence of all those different
pills. I mean, Joe, I've been homeopathic for about 15 years now. I have not been to the doctor. You know, and you haven't either, really.
Yeah, but for some reason, I always seem to get by. But I did get started to get better when I went to the doctor and they prescribed some very basic stuff. I mean, I just take some Pepcid now, and that solves a lot of my throat problems. I didn't have any today when we went out to get a quick bite to eat. But the thing about it is, in the kind of libertarian bullshit society that the guys like Neil Bortz and Rush Limbaugh talk about, you know, they would have said to my wife, "Fuck you." Because to them, she wasn't worth anything. She didn't have a lot of money. But you know what? She meant everything to me. You know, she was my world, and I was her world. And I may be taking it real nice on the outside, but inside, I'm a big wreck because I was so lonely before she came into my life. And even though we still had problems and I was still stressed out over things, I always knew that I had someone to come home to. It was a very special relationship. I really don't have words for it. I could tell her anything. The most deepest secrets that I'm afraid to tell anybody, I could tell her. And it didn't bother her. She was understanding. And she was such a loving and caring person. I mean, when she'd hear a certain song on the radio, she'd come up to me and she'd start hugging me. And she'd start, you know, kissing on my neck and... I remember once when we were, and she was generally not given to public displays, but when we were at Anime Weekend one year and I was on stage, here I am on stage in front of a couple of thousand people, just having some fun and talking about some stuff. And we were at the opening ceremony, so we were throwing out candy, which is one of the traditions they have at Anime Weekend. And she comes running up on stage, says, "This is the only kind of candy I want," comes up and gives me a big kiss. And she had never done that for anybody before. You know, little things that... You know, she talked about how she could be completely free with me, too. I mean, that's such a wonderful, special relationship. People die for that. People write stories about that. And I really don't have any way of expressing how great the loss is. It really hasn't kicked in yet because I've been busy with the funeral arrangements and I've still got other responsibilities and I've been busy reorganizing the room here, but... It's starting to kick in now. I mean, you know, I'm having trouble sleeping. Last night I started to break down a little bit because everything finally got a little quiet and I got settled and I started thinking about her. And every time I do think about her, I get a little sad. And again, it's not a sense of regret or anger, and you know, why was she taken from me? I understand people get sick, you know, and it wasn't anybody's fault, really. And if she had died in a car wreck, maybe it would have been a lot worse, but it would have been more sudden, but... You know, I kind of had an idea that she was in bed. I was hoping against hope that she would improve and get better. But I'm really, really going to miss it. And before I say anything else, I really, really want to thank all the people who have sent condolences and people who have donated money. You know, I'm still strapped for cash. If anybody wants to donate, it's cupjoe.com/donate.htm. Just go to the website, cupofjoe.blogspot.com. And there's a little thing there you can click.
Yeah, the donations have really represented what democracy used to be about.
Sure.
You know, we help each other. Then at some point, Joe, you'll be back on your feet. You'll be helping someone else.
And that's the way we all help
each other. Where is community anymore? Why aren't we helping the Katrina people? I mean, everybody gives their little $5 or $10 at the Publix the first day Katrina
hits. Well, a lot of people can't
afford
it.
And then they forget about it.
But then a lot of people also can't afford to give.
Oh, please. Everybody
can
give. Everybody could afford $5 more out of their pocket.
I could probably donate $5 or so.
You know?
I haven't done so because,
when I was talking to that lady, Sandra, from the Georgia Hunger Coalition, what a wise, wonderful, spiritual woman. I said, what happened to our communities? You know, the African Americans used to have a sense of community. And even the Europeans, when they came over, they instilled a sense of community in America. We were talking about this at lunch. All of a sudden, the suburbia broke up this American community where we don't help our neighbors anymore.
It's always been kind of like out in the sense of community is always, you know, it seems the opposite because you have this whole little house on the prairie point of view of the rural areas. But really the stronger senses of community were always in the urban centers because people lived a lot closer together. It was out in the boondocks where you had a lot more of the racism and a lot more of the
ignorance,
because people were out there. And I'm not just talking about ignorance in terms of not necessarily getting education, because, you know, you can give or take that. But I'm talking about ignorance and preconceived ideas.
They're just taught hateful ideas, you know. But I want to talk a little bit about the people like Kathy's friends on the Pogo community.
Yeah, yeah. We build online communities. I mean, the people who donated to me, who gave to me, there were a lot of these people that I had never personally met in my life, you know, in person.
That's
astounding,
Joe.
I know them online. I know them from the political sites. You know, some of them I talked to on the phone, Ben Birch from the White Rose Society. And Ben is doing such a wonderful job, and it's hopeful that he can get his radio thing going.
I would love to see him and everything he's doing get syndicated. Brad Friedman gets syndicated.
Right.
You, Joe. I mean, we need a 24-hour syndicated radio, left-wing radio.
Well, I'm gonna blow my own
not
horn.
Not just Air America. Not enough.
Yeah, I'm going to blow my own horn and say they need people like me. Because a lot, you know, I love Al Franken as a comedian. He's a wonderful guy in person, I'm sure. I've never met him personally. I love Janine Garofalo as an actress. I like Randy Rhoads, and I don't know much about Randy Rhoads, so maybe I'm not saying this for her, but who was it? Laura Flanders, I was on her show, and she seems nice. But you know what? These are all well-educated people who were brought up in very rich families for the most part, at least a lot richer than I have always been. And quite frankly, they just don't fucking get it. They just don't get it. I'm not saying anything about them personally, because like I said, I'm sure they're nice people, and they do a wonderful job with their radio shows, but you know what? They don't understand what's happening down here at the bottom. So you and I, where did we go today? We went to thrift stores.
We got everything that we could have gotten at a Macy's for $100. We got for $10.
And you know, it's real nice to go into stuff places like
and
that. And
Dove and Caress, actual name brands, soaps that cost $1, whereas I'd have paid $4 or $5 in a CVS.
Yeah,
now,
exactly.
What's up with that?
So, you know, and you get stuff and you know, and that's really what it's come to in this country, where you have to go to stores and places like that to get reasonable price. I mean, people used to go to the Macy's and the Sears and all these other places because the prices were relatively reasonable.
The difference is you can live just like a rich person, but you don't have to rip people off. Or in my case, when I was a salesman in the corporate world, I just realized that the line beyond which I was not willing to walk was lying to my customer.
Right.
And telling them that I would sell them a product that was not finished or not ready. I would not do that.
Right.
I just wouldn't. So,
and neither would Kathy, which is why she was never, you know, tremendously economically successful. Let me tell you, you know, she used to tell the story all the time about the first job she had. She was basically rolling silverware at an S&S cafeteria. And then she noticed that the guy who was cleaning the dishes, and if you've ever been to a cafeteria like that, the way they clean the dishes, they have this big, like, a dishwasher that's got, like, a belt that goes through it where it cleans and comes out the other side. You know, big places like that have stuff like that. And she would help him out. And then they made that part of her regular job. Did they pay her more? No. You know? And now, who is it? There's some other companies that are in lawsuits right now where they weren't paying Hispanics and black people overtime pay for extra hours that they were working. The reason why I get on Walmart is because they'll make people work overtime and not pay them. They'll literally steal hours from their employees. I mean, that's not a way to run a business. You know, I don't give a shit how much profit they make. That's not about, you know, you talk about building communities. These things destroy communities. We were talking about housing earlier at lunch today. One of the reasons why communities get destroyed is because when a lot of these rich people buy houses nowadays, they're not buying a house for the sake of buying a house saying, here's where we're going to live for the rest of our lives. No, they're buying a house saying, we'll stay here for 5 years, and when the property values go up, then we'll sell it and move on to someplace else. That's wrong. I think that's just plain wrong. You're buying a house because you're looking at a place to say, this is where I want to live. This is where I want to spend the rest of my life. This is a house I want to pass on to my children.
Yeah, but when I was in Red Bank, New Jersey, and when I would drive right next to Ocean Grove, was this very rich, rich beachfront community. Every one of these rich houses had the manicured lawns to the point of being boring. Ugly, you know, the manicured bushes. Do you know what, Joe? I would go there during the day, right after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. In the summer, I never saw a single kid playing in their front yard. These communities, their children, they're living these really jaded, sort of sheltered lives.
Sterile.
I feel sterile. I feel sorry for those kinds of rich communities.
Well, again,
they never have lights on their house at Halloween or Christmas.
Again, I don't really. They're not really going through. It's not a question of feeling sorry for them or not, and they're entitled to live that kind of life if they want to live that kind of life. But you know what? Leave us alone.
Yeah.
You know, leave us the hell alone. We deserve the right for those of us who just.
Well, how about this? How about just pay your goddamn taxes?
Yeah.
They wouldn't even have to do anything but that. Just corporations pay your taxes and rich people pay your taxes. And that's it. We would pay off the Iraq debt. We would pay off the Social Security debt. We'd pay off all this debt if we just made Bell South and Verizon, all these bullshit telecom firms that are so in debt, pay your goddamn taxes. You know?
And then, you know, we could build a social infrastructure. A lot of it is just racist.
And then Kathy, you know, she could go to some social center. She could have gotten the health sooner. You know, she waited because, you know, it's not there for people.
It would have been a lot easier for us. I mean, you know, you could have had a much better public transportation system than what we have here in Atlanta. And the reason why it sucks is because it's not publicly funded. But we could have. We could have had a much better system for that. They do have a system at Grady for people who, you know, have trouble walking, so then they pick up back and forth. But sometimes that can be a lot of trouble for that, too.
I mean,
and they always make it so hard on you. Yeah. I mean, okay, you know, I was telling about the food stamp thing here. Now, Kathy and I are on food stamps, and, you know, I brought this up in that punish for being poor thing, where they required me, because I was getting food stamps for me and Kathy, but Kathy couldn't come because of her health, and I had to go and sit in this room for six days a month. You know, supposedly it was work experience, but it wasn't doing anything to help me work. It was just basically, it was a way of making me so fed up with it that I wouldn't get food stamps anymore, so that they could save a few dollars and not have to pay me any food stamps. And now that Kathy's passed on, you know, they're going to make me go back and say, I get less money, but I have to spend less time in it. But you know what? I'm not sitting there for 3 days a month in this room just doing absolutely nothing. You know, you want to help me find the job, you help me find the job. I'm perfectly happy for that because I want to work. I don't want to be on food stamps. You know, but I'm giving it up because I absolutely do not want to go through this. Period. I do not want to go through this.
It's the same kind of belittling thing that they're making the Katrina survivors. You know, I met two Katrina survivors from New Orleans, Joe and Angela. And the only reason that they actually got placed into a home was because when they got off the plane, the military airplane, which, by the way, their story is really interesting. They had a National Guard guy fully armed with an M16 gun, crash through their window at 12 midnight and point the laser sight and come inches away from killing them, okay? Because they were one of the last people that were – they would see the boats and they would never flag them down, Joe, because they were afraid of the American military.
Well, it's,
they had no idea where they were going to be taken. They had no idea if they were going to – so the only reason that they got placed into a house as opposed to getting up to Rock Eagle, which is like a military camp. It's cots and they lock you there. You can't leave that area. As there are 2,000 Katrina survivors not allowed to leave, a cot by cot by cot. It was a place we used to put teenagers during summer camp. It's not a place to live, okay? It's not even good temporary housing.
And let me guess, 90 to 100% of those people were what color?
Probably African American.
You see, there's so much racism in this
country.
But
Joe and Angela were like, we were so lucky that we had a health issue. They took us straight to Grady, and then from there they took us to a church, and then we got placed into a home, and they found – so Joe and Angela both have jobs. They're happy to be working. They didn't want a handout. So they're in a good situation. But these people up at Rock Eagle – and I've written an editorial about it, and nobody believes me, but I think those buses and those airplanes that would take people off without telling them where they were going, does that sound familiar? Have you heard of the trains to Auschwitz?
Mm.
I think that these people are being carted off because they're seen as bad. The Bush administration sees poor people as bad people.
And
black, fuck-ups.
Black people in particular. Because you know what?
Digby, and they're not fuck-ups. They're just not willing to be greedy sellouts.
Digby has been talking about this, too. And he said one of the reasons why, and I agree with him, one of the big reasons why we don't have decent social infrastructure in this country, the kind of health care that they have, say, in Europe or Japan, the kind of train systems that can take you around the country very cheaply and very quickly and very energy efficiently. The big reason for that is because of black people. They don't want the black people to be moving around. If we didn't have any black people in this country, we would have that stuff. Because you know what? White people are perfectly happy with welfare for them. You know, wealth, and they're perfectly happy with welfare for wealthy corporations. They're perfectly happy with that. No one says anything about it. You know, when Reagan talked about welfare queens, guess who he was talking about? He was talking about black people. And so long as politicians are able to tap into that racism, they're going to be able to be successful in the things that they do. And that's just sickening. That's really just sickening. And even though Kathy was white, you know, and really more white people are on welfare than black people. That's a statistic nobody likes to talk about, but it's the truth. More white people are on welfare than black people.
Well, I tell you what. All I have to do is look at the polls that 2% of the African American community still has supports Bush. Tells me that community as a community are A, smart as hell, B, politically involved, right? C, they get it. They know who their enemies are. And they know who not to support. It's a scathing indictment against white people that we're still supporting Bush.
And who are the 2% of the black people? That's what I want to know.
Well, it's Condoleezza and her friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the wannabe Republican
House Negroes.
Even gay people. We have our log cabin Republicans.
House
I hate
Negroes.
To break
Harry Belafonte was absolutely, absolutely right. That's what Colin Powell is, a House Negro. Somebody who's just going to carry water for their white masters. That's what Condi does. That's what Colin does.
I don't know. Before you slam Colin, you know, he was a good guy before he got involved with the Bush administration.
No, he wasn't. He was one of the guys that helped cover up the My Lai massacre back in Vietnam. So he has a history.
Oh, well.
He has a history of carrying water for his
superiors. I thought he did well in the first Gulf War.
Well, you know, he was there.
Okay.
He was there. And again, you know, you were fighting, you know, the Iraqi military was so overwhelmed.
But I think, don't you think he had a crisis in conscience after having to lie to the UN?
He's got his money. He doesn't care.
Okay.
He doesn't really care. He's out of the power play. He knows they're not going to hurt him anyway. And maybe he's trying to push her running for president anyway. Maybe they can say, well, he can be the Harkonnen.
Oh, he could have ran for president, but he screwed up.
But, you know, and you know, there's a lot of Republicans who will blame. And, you know, you got the Reverend Fred Phelps people who are out there, you know, happy that Katrina happened because it killed a lot of black people and it killed a lot. You know, they'd say that was punishment for New Orleans for being, you know, for the French Quarter, all the stuff. But you know what? The French Quarter was largely spared the devastation. So what does that say?
But, you know, so I love it when Randy Rhodes says that they're killing off entire cities. They're putting people on buses and separating them from their kids. Anywhere else in the world, this would be seen as an absolute tragedy. And yet, because Bush can say, well, instead of police officers, we now need military.
Yep.
He's wanting to replace everything with the military. And what's so fucked up about that is that the military they should be used in a, you know, last ditch effort. And we shouldn't be using them, like, you know, to go and fix domestic crime.
Well, you know, the
National Guard type stuff.
The National Guard is what really is supposed to be doing. And that they're kind of a military operation. But the National Guard, of course, is over in Iraq. And the guys I really felt bad for were the poor guys who were from New Orleans who were fighting in Iraq, wondering if they're going to have a city to come home to. Could you imagine that?
Well, did you hear on Mike Malloy, and I never heard whether it was confirmed or not, but that the Georgia, Louisiana, and Mississippi National Guards were going to try to do a mutiny. And actually, at one point, they said they could go home to fix the problems at home. And then they shipped a plane in, and the plane was sitting on the ground in Iraq. And they had all the guys right there at the airport. And then some big commander from high on said, if we let some of these guys go, it may start a domino effect, and other Iraqi soldiers may want to go home. So we better not do this. So what I heard was that the soldiers got on the plane and they were very reluctant to get off. And I never heard whether that was confirmed or not. I'm sure it was hushed up the minute it happened. But I think if any Iraqi soldiers are listening to the show, you know, I know you could get court-martialed, so I'm not encouraging you to do anything that isn't orchestrated in volumes. But, you know, come on home. Help us out here. We need it.
Well, don't go AWOL. Don't endanger yourselves because, you know, the attitude issued on site. There was some news stories about
1,000 people filed, what do you call it, conscientious objector paperwork?
But not when you're already
20,000 people?
Not when you're already in. You can't do that.
Nothing happens to you when you file the paperwork. It's just that they're going to ignore the paperwork.
Yeah, but I don't think, I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think you can file that after you've already sworn the oath. And
yes,
that's
you can.
Just a thing.
Yes, you can. Kevin Benderman was in for 10 years. And he filed it. Now, where they got him was he didn't go back.
When he placed under
arrest,
and then
he got 15 months of...
Well, that's just the thing. He was already under oath, and they
placed him under
arrest.
But not for filing the paperwork. Where he got in trouble was that he was never... First of all, he should have never gone to jail. That was a sham. I was in the courtroom. The Army, there is no justice. It's a kangaroo court. But where he got in trouble was his commander was not clear, did not tell him to get on the airplane. His commander told him to go home and be with his wife, and he did exactly that. So Kevin Benderman should have never gone to jail. It was a total crock. He had the best lawyers, and even the judge was making fun of the Army lawyers. But the bottom line is, if you file conscientious paperwork, they're going to harass you. But if they got 15,000, 20,000 soldiers starting to file conscientious objector packets, they're going to start seeing, hey, this is not a popular war.
Well, with all the stop loss that they're having and all the extended tours, you know, and the constant
if you go there, it's Hotel California. The Army is Hotel California. You can check in, but you can never leave.
Yeah. And the thing was, the Republic used to bitch about that because they did some stop loss stuff when Clinton was in there too, but as I keep pointing out, and as others keep pointing out, no soldier that Clinton sent into combat died. And don't give me the Somalia stuff. Somalia, the soldiers that were in Somalia were sent there by the first Bush, not by Bill Clinton, and were not supported by Colin Powell. And by Bush in the first
place. Isn't
it
funny, the 8 years of a Democrat, and magically there are no wars. And then the 4 years
Oh, there were wars. It was Bosnia. Don't forget Bosnia. There was Haiti.
Right.
But the only soldiers that died under Clinton were a couple that committed suicide.
Yeah.
And that was it. No one died. No American soldier died in Haiti. No American soldier died in Bosnia. And, of course, what they'll say is it's because they were mostly bombing and not sending a lot of troops in. But you know what? Clinton can go to Bosnia and to Central Europe like that, and he gets greeted as a hero. And what did George Bush say in his choreographed press conference? He said, it'll be a while before I can get back to Baghdad.
How many more things does Bush have to do before the people are in the streets with pitchforks?
Well, you know, the cultists are always going to believe, no matter what happens, they're always going to believe in Mr. Bush because they're cultists. That's the way they
think.
Yeah,
but that's 1% of the population.
That's more than 1%.
No.
That's a considerable amount of people who have a vested interest now in maintaining their illusion because they put so much investment into it.
Well, my brother and sisters, you know.
Well, you know, they're going to have to pay the piper eventually.
But I was going to ask you, you know, what do you think about the indictments, the Patrick Fitzgerald indictments?
Well, I don't want to talk about that.
Okay. Just,
we started talking about Kathy, and I wanted to put it, you know. And Kathy was heartbroken about all of this. And she used to be a Bush supporter. And I explained to her a lot of things that was going on, and I explained a lot of things that were happening with Clinton. And she was really, really surprised. So you can turn some of these people. But then again, Kathy was fairly much more open. A lot of Kathy's family are still strong Bush supporters. And
I think it's culture and society. If you grew up going to NASCAR and, you know, your dad's kind of one of those good old boys, you're probably going to be a Republican. And it goes back to the whole, you know, psyche of, I mean, I admit I vote Democrat the way my dad voted. But what's interesting is in my family, a lot of my brothers and sisters have become Republican out of what I think to be a philosophical framework, a mindset that money is important, that big houses are important. Granted, these big houses never make them happy. They're always stressed out. They're running from gig to gig to gig. They never slow down. They have no concept of the spiritual concept of being in the now. And that was one thing Kathy really had down, is when you were around Kathy, she gave you this sense of calm, almost like she knew what the way to live was.
Right. And she was a very passionate person. I mean, when you were, you know, on a very personal level, she had a lot of passion inside of her that she didn't show that often. A lot of things she was very shy to do in public, she would not hesitate to do when we were alone.
She was talented with her crocheting, do you call it?
Cross-stitching.
I gave her a photograph that I took of a giraffe at the Atlanta Zoo. And she literally drew her own, stenciled her own pattern, and then stitched it for me and made it to me and gave it to me. And I was so blown away because this cross-stitch looked more like the photograph than the photograph.
I wouldn't go that far, but it was a good job.
It was, I mean, she had the shading down to the colors. It was amazing.
And the thing about it is we had always talked about her making a living doing that. And, you know, the thing is she used to go to flea markets and sell stuff like that. And I said, you know what, that's the wrong audience for that. Because people go to flea market you know, you look at how much time, because she used to make those little candles, yeah, the little Christmas candles, and it took her a couple hours to make a candle, which, you know, but she was charging maybe I think $1 a candle. And I said, you look at that, that's 50 cents an hour for your labor.
Yeah.
You know, you deserve to be making a lot more of that. The people you should be selling this to are the really, really rich people, like you talked about, who take pride in owning handmade stuff. You spend a little bit more on materials, perhaps, and you charge 20 or 30 bucks per candle.
Yeah.
And this way, you make up for it, because these people don't care. $20 or $30 to them is nothing. That's like a nickel to you and me. You know,
But craftsmen is how people used to support themselves. You know, mm-hmm, either the mountain communities, that's how they support themselves. But we've lost that concept of craft in our culture as well. You know, because A, people don't buy it as much, and B, you know, you really can't make a living on it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start to put an end to this here, because actually we've talked for almost an hour, and that's really surprised me, because I didn't know how long we were going to be able to talk. Again, I want to thank everybody who sent their condolences. Oh, before we go, Phyllis, and let me let you plug your new show.
Oh, well, I just did an anniversary show called Radio Free Rigel. It's on www.countpaperballots.com/video/Nashville video. And it's about Cindy Sheehan and how she's transforming into a spiritual leader. And it's about the Patrick Fitzgerald indictment.
Okay, if you just go to countpaperballots.com, though,
you click on the video link.
Yeah, you'll get to it, because people type in all that stuff in there. Count Paper Ballots. That's why I use cupjoe.com. Anyway, again, thank you to everybody who donated money, or who didn't donate money but sent condolences. You know, I wasn't looking for the money, but the money did help out. Cost me a bunch of money to go down to Florida, and I had to get a new bed. You know, Phyllis was talking about it. Some people get excited about certain things. You get excited about buying a new bed, which is a fairly common piece of thing.
A very basic item that most people already have.
You know, but it was stuff that I needed, and it was very nice.
And you gave the boys some money.
Yes, I gave the boys some money,
and they're really happy
to
have it. So.
Anyway, the next show will be back to normal, and hopefully it'll be fairly soon. By the way, the Cup of Joe show, as it's known, is going to be coming to an end if the Ben Birch thing gets over, because I'm going to be doing a show with a different name. It'll be the same basic thing, but Cup of Joe isn't quite as good as the new name of the show, which I won't reveal just yet.
And I don't like it, but that's all right.
Well, that's okay.
I like Cup of Joe.
Ben likes it, and he thinks it'll be a better sell.
Okay.
So, and that's really, really more important.
Yeah.
So, anyway, this is Joe Vecchio saying thank you, Phyllis Euster, and we will be back for next time, whenever next time will be. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Joe, I'll crave a plate of Dave, open a jar of John, don't put anything on, I'll chug a jug of George, I'll sip a mug of Doug, with the creamer of Steve, how many more does that leave? You'd be a pot of Scott, heat up a pan of Stan, throw in a handful of Dick, that'll do every day, open a can of Dan, make a meal of Sam, but don't give me no mo, cause what I really want's a cup of Joe.
The Cup of Joe radio show has been recorded live at the fabulous Studio Al in Decatur, Georgia, and has been produced by Jove Enterprises, Incorporated. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is a production of Mr. and Mrs. Vecchio of Brooklyn, New York.
A plate of Dave, creamer of Steve, a mug of Doug, a cup of...